terrible things, I can almost always find a way to see things from their point of view, or at least empathize with why they might have acted the way they did or said the things they said. I believe there's always a past reason for someone's actions against you. And now, if a professional sporting coach is front page news because they're getting mercilessly sacked, I always think of their families. The family that didn't choose to be put in the spotlight, but simply supported their loved ones. They didn't ask to have the whole city, the state, even the whole country talking about them, abusing them, attacking them emotionally and physically. I thank my lucky stars that I wasn't older and that social media was not yet in play. My resilience now allows me to live a public life online, immune to the vitriol and lies directed both towards and against me on a daily basis. But towards my loved ones? That's where I am my father's daughter. I am able to contain any form of reaction towards imbeciles online, but am simultaneously a fierce lioness protecting those in my pride at all times. A coach might be a dickhead. Maybe they've made some horrible decisions throughout the season, and yeah, maybe their team sucks. But think of the kids at home who have to front up to school, and the wife whose name gets dragged through the mud. And don't you dare try to argue to me that that's what they signed up for. No 5-year-old girl deserves to be bashed at school because her dad's football team lost a fucking game. Only recently, my sister messaged me about that incident in primary school so many years ago. I've never forgotten that moment, she wrote, and I live with so much guilt around it because I couldn't help my baby sister. Looking at my innocent children now, I can't imagine what I would do if something like that happened to them. And I can't imagine what it did to my parents, to my dad, knowing that his career dreams were shattering the lives of his family. I always say I was Dad's boy experiment. As the last of 4 girls, people would often joke with me that my dad was disappointed that he hadn't managed to have a son. And whilst he will vehemently deny any truth to that, there probably was a part of him that wished for a son, so I somehow became stand-in. One of my earliest memories with my dad is him teaching me how to kick a drop punt with an AFL footy. He taught me how to kick a torpedo too, and to use a speedball. He put a cricket bat in my hand at 3 years old and I played my first game at 5, receiving a hat trick on my first 3 balls in my opening over in under 10 boys. Fond memories surround family cricket games down in Bamborough Street, Lauderdale, where my older cousins would help me wrap my cricket ball with electrical tape to help me bowl a leg spinner to my wicketkeeper cousin behind the stumps. That cousin is former Australian cricket captain Tim Payne. Everyone thought it was so cute back then because girls didn't do those sorts of things. So I was his token little boy. But while Dad was the one out with me in the yard, busy teaching me all the boy stuff, it was Mum I desperately wanted to impress. With 4 kids, my household was extremely busy while I was growing up. I didn't have time to sook, cry, or shout for attention, so I had to figure out very quickly how to just get on with things. I was independent from a young age with things like tying my shoes and dressing myself for school because Mum didn't have time to work her way down the queue to me. I often refer to my childhood as having to jump a little higher to be seen in my house. Not that I feel hard done by it all, but now, as an adult, I do crave a closer relationship with my mum. I've always yearned for that best friend relationship with her, probably because I didn't get a lot of one-on-one time with her as a kid. I wasn't neglected in any way, not at all, but I do think my mum was so busy with everyone else and, as I later learnt, trying to stay afloat in a high-pressure marriage, that when she saw I had been born a pretty confident, self-sufficient young girl, she devoted more attention to my sisters. It created a pattern for us that's persisted into my adulthood. She still thinks that I don't need her because, to this day, I am that strong-willed, independent, I'll be okay on my own type of girl. But the truth is, I do need my mum, more than I've ever liked to admit. I really, truly do. In everything I did as a kid, and still in so much that I do now, it's all to make my mum proud of me, and I'm always waiting to hear those words. But I very rarely heard them. This is where Mum and I are intrinsically different. I am a hyper-emotional communicator, whether good or bad. My mum, however, is a closed book to me. I know she is proud of me, even if she doesn't know how to say it, and I'm sure it'll probably upset her to know how much it still kills me, that I am still that little girl longing for those words. Somewhere inside, even at 31 years of age, I'm still the young girl yearning for mummy to come give me a cuddle. I don't recall growing up in a house where we said, I love you, a lot either. I know I was loved. My mum was, and still is, gentle and warm. She's very shy and reserved, again, the polar opposite to the woman I am now. Mum is someone who doesn't say much, but she will always share that her four beautiful girls are her greatest achievement in life. My mum shows her love in other ways, and that's something I've had to come to understand more and more as I've grown older. That people show love in different ways, and that we must accept emotions in diverse forms, even ones that are in contrast to how our own brains are wired. We all have unique attachment styles, distinctive love languages. My sisters and I have always said that Mum would never actually apologise if she'd upset us. I don't think I've ever heard the word sorry come out of her mouth. But if any of us had had an argument with her in the morning, for instance, you'd get home from school and your whole bedroom would be clean. There'd be a new set of sheets on the bed and there'd be a beautiful candle lit in your room. That's Mum's way. That's how she shows love, by doing things for others without words. To this day, I'll invite her over for dinner and she'll arrive and just start doing the washing or tidying the kids' rooms. I have to ask or even yell over and over for her to please just relax, sit down, and to let me cook dinner for her. It's just how she uniquely shows her love, but it is something that I still struggle with. Sometimes I do just want to hear those words, I love you. I loved a girl so desperately once, and upon reflection with my psychologist, I came to realise that it was because she treated me with the same somewhat tough love I felt my mum did. It was a very non-verbal, actions over communication type of love. And just like I have with my mum over the years, I spent far too long trying to change her, to get her to love me in the way I wanted to be loved, instead of simply accepting her way of offering it. My struggles came from not acknowledging the differences in how people convey love. I am loud, proud, and expressive with my emotions, and I now overcompensate with my own kids to make up for the verbal validation I didn't receive as a child. I tell them 50,000 times a day, you are beautiful, you are great, I love you, because I think children need to hear those things. I know I needed to hear them. When I'm telling Bobby and Florence how much I love them and how proud I am of them, I make them look deep into my eyes so that I know they're listening and really absorbing what I'm saying. As their mother, their nurturer, and their safe place, it's crucial to me that they really comprehend how much I adore them and that it's embedded into their minds throughout adulthood that they were loved. In fairness, Mum also finds my personality polarizing at times. These days, when I try to talk to her about things that are negative or perhaps uncomfortable for her, she feels like I'm on the attack and will walk away, avoiding any form of a serious discussion. Many introverts I've discovered in life will interpret such conversations as threatening and critical, whereas to me, it's just an open discussion, an integral part of making my way through life. So I do find it sad that there are times I'm simply trying to open up a dialogue, only to be ignored and criticised for attacking people. I pride myself on my communication skills and letting people know how their actions make me feel, whether good or bad, but it's certainly a skill I've had to teach myself along the way and something I still work at now. I have most certainly inherited my dad's temper and at times rage, and a confrontation is something I will never shy away from. But I suppose now, with maturity and having undergone an evolution into the woman I am today, I've also learned to protect my energy and to be smarter with my battles. I think too many people mistake a calm, rational discussion, even one expressing a difference of opinion, for a verbal attack, and I believe it's their own insecurity that is creating that reality for them. A conversation might be uncomfortable or unpleasant to have, but that doesn't make it an argument. I see this a lot online as I regularly engage in open discussions with my followers about different viewpoints with an open mindset, but only when approached in a similarly respectful manner. My mum has said to me on more than a few occasions, "You think I'm not communicative? You should see what my mum was like, as if it's some sort of competition for who had it worse. And I do get a bit frustrated with her. If something her mother did hurt her, like a lack of communication or support, I've always questioned why she wouldn't try to break those patterns for her own kids. That's the exact reason I've chosen my parenting style to almost smother my children with an abundance of praise and love, to the point where they'll probably turn around one day and say, "Mum, shut the fuck up. We get it. You love us." I, alongside with their dad, work very hard to make sure our home is an accepting, loving space with free-flowing conversation where my children and their friends can come, knowing they can discuss anything without fear of judgment or discipline, where they can feel safe in how they are processing something and will never be told their emotions are invalid, regardless of whether, as parents, we agree or disagree with the situation. To allow them as children and as they transition into teens and then adults, to feel everything that they need to feel. I don't believe any experience should be shut off. I want my children to be exposed to as many emotions and situations as possible, so that as they do evolve, they get to shape who they are themselves instead of being molded into what we as parents want them to be. There is one moment with my mum, though, that I will always look to as a reminder of how much she loves me. And every time I recall this moment, I physically hold my open palms over my heart and my face beams with a smile. When I gave birth to Bobby, I didn't want my mum in the room with me. I'm 22. I'm independent. I'm having this baby with Jared. I'm an adult now. But when it came to birthing Florence, all I wanted was mum. I initially hadn't planned to have her there. It had never occurred to me. It was going to be just Jared and me again, along with the student midwife I'd brought along for the journey. Yet during my labour, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the idea that I needed a strong female presence in the room with me. Jared and I never found out what gender we were having before either labour, and throughout my second pregnancy, I was convinced it was another boy. Hank, he would be called. Bobby and Hank Keisha. However, during my peaceful 8-hour labour at home and into my active labour at the hospital, my intuition was speaking loudly to me, telling me it was going to be a girl. A spur-of-the-moment thought, amidst snippets of a gas-induced hallucination that I was Poppy from Trolls slip and sliding down a rainbow, was that I needed my mum by my side. Immediately. Not to hold my hand, but to be a symbolic presence when I brought my baby girl into the world. I was literally mid-contraction when I grabbed Jared's arm. "Get mum. I want my mum," I told him. We have a joke now that she must have been doing laps of the hospital in her car, because she was there in an instant, in typical mum fashion, hair freshly blow-waved, gorgeous new seed shirt on, like she'd been waiting for that exact call. Mum immediately changed that environment for me. I was instantly calm, further highlighting that no matter where I believe I'm at in life and how much I've grown up, and despite the fact that we have butted heads so often throughout our lives, I will always feel at home with my mum. She didn't interfere. She did just enough to let me know she was right there with me. Without instruction, she opened up the birth suite blinds, the beautiful evening sun beaming right onto all of us. It no longer felt so clinical and scary, the natural light and warmth, symbolic of the beautiful little ray of sunshine that was about to greet us earthside. After Florence, originally named Betty but later changed, was born and mum had gone, she sent me a text message and it's one I've cherished ever since. That was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life, to see my own baby girl birth her very own baby girl, she wrote. It's something I'll never forget. I love you so much, and I am so proud of you. Chapter 3. Despite the horror of the Adelaide years, Dad gave us a pretty blessed life, hanging out with AFL legends like Kevin Sheedy and his kids on the weekend, travelling with the team to interstate games, taking the 2000 Premiership Cup to school for show and tell. It definitely wasn't all bad. But we did travel a lot with his job, which meant moving house and changing schools often, so again, I had to learn to be very adaptable from a young age. We lived in Melbourne off and on, with stints in both Adelaide and Tasmania too. My dad even went over to Perth for 2 years on his own in a general manager role at Fremantle Football Club while I did my final years of high school in Melbourne. High school, as we know, can be tough for so many reasons. I loved school, but I've had a wall up from a young age. At times, it was pretty fucking brutal, to be honest. I was one of the cool girls, and ew, I hate that phrase now, part of the in crowd, but I was always the first to cop shit from other people. One of my best mates in year seven was this gorgeous girl. She had beautiful olive skin, she had big boobs already, and she'd had braces in primary school, so her teeth were impeccable by the time she reached year seven. A couple of teenage zits, but it was nothing. She was simply stunning, a Kourtney Kardashian type vibe. We quickly became best friends, but I was her opposite. Pale, see-through skin, thick, bushy eyebrows, body covered in freckles. I didn't have pimples at that stage, however, I was really self-conscious about my freckles. I remember going to her one day to seek some reassurance. "Do you reckon my freckles are that bad?" I asked her one afternoon in her bedroom, having swiped on thick layers of Maybelline Mousse foundation in an attempt to disguise the spots. "I can cover them if they're really that bad." She shot me a look. I'd much rather have pimples than freckles. At least you can get rid of pimples. It might not seem that big a deal to some, but as a 12-year-old girl hitting puberty, wanting my friend's approval and support, it was a horrible thing to hear. I interpret her words as something more along the lines of, "Your face is ugly and you can't change it." That wasn't the first time I felt unsupported by my social circle. A year earlier, in year six, my group came up to me one day and announced that they didn't want to be my friends anymore, and I was banished from playing with them in the yard. People who know me best now know that I take responsibility for my shit, as I am far from perfect. I am the first to stand up and accept responsibility for anything I've done wrong to someone or in times I've upset them. This goes back to my belief in the power of open communication. But this time around, nothing had prompted it. They just stopped talking to me out of the blue without warning. I didn't get the opportunity to fight my case in the lunch break. We never spoke again. It's a theme I saw repeated in high school and one that continued well into my early adult years. For the longest time, I've tried to look inside from an unbiased viewpoint to figure out where I was messing up, why people I believe I loved and cared for so much seemed to be turning away from me. I always figured that if everyone else thought I was the problem, then I must be. What am I doing wrong? Situations like that also really shaped a huge part of my life. It killed me at the time when people would behave that way, but it certainly made me stronger because I had no option but to cop it on the chin and learn to back myself. It took me a really long time to realize that sometimes people treat you like shit because they're intimidated by you, by your choices in life. I think the confidence I've maintained in situations where society has told women to sit the fuck down for so long has been intimidating for some people I've known in my life. My tendency to stand up for the little guy, as well as being brave enough to form my own opinions in the face of fixed mindsets, has also got me in trouble growing up. I've always been quick to challenge people's actions if I didn't think they were right or fair, and it never sat well with me when my high school peers would be so judgmental of choices that were counter to what they would do. I'm sure we can all recall moments sitting around with friends at lunch at high school, talking about classmates, commenting on what someone was wearing on the weekend or who they were dating. For me, even if I didn't know them or they were in the group of girls who I wasn't supposed to like, I would refuse to comment or try to steer the conversation in another direction. "Who cares?" I'd ask. "That's her business. It doesn't impact us." Unfortunately, holding people accountable for poor comments in moments like these often makes them feel very uncomfortable. And I came to learn that when I've challenged others' way of thinking throughout my life, it can lead to me being labelled as problematic. Imagine being the girl in a cliquey high school group, an environment in which teenagers are constantly seeking acceptance and approval from their peers, and choosing to go against the grain, having the confidence to stand alone, to form my own opinions and belief at the risk of not fitting in with the crowd. I would always ask, "Does that really matter to us though? Why does that bother you so much if they do that? Why do you care what car she drives?" Trivial matters, really, But the topics themselves weren't the point of the issue. The problem was that I was, and always have been, okay to run my own race, even if it meant I was disliked. What other people were doing truly never worried me. If it didn't affect my life, why would I give it energy and attention? So at 14, 17, 25, I was making some acquaintances reflect on their actions, and I don't think that felt good for them. I was branded difficult. Ironic now, really, that I work in a world where I face people like this every day, commenting, criticizing, forming opinions on my life, what I'm doing, what I'm wearing, who I'm dating, despite it having zero effect on their own lives. I reflected on it a lot over the years until I finally realized that my presence, my very being, makes people feel uncomfortable. It's not intentional, of course, but my confidence, my approach to life, and my willingness to call others out on their bullshit and to call myself out when I need to, that scares people. I'm constantly asking myself, how can I be better? How can I do better? How can I be a better friend, a better partner, a better colleague? I'm always looking for ways to improve as a human, and I think that can make a lot of people uneasy because it forces them to look at themselves too. It forces them to face some potentially grim truths about themselves, and they can uncover parts of their own personalities they don't like so much. I am not fucking perfect. I make terrible choices at times. I've treated people horribly at times in my life, and I've certainly done and said many things that I'm not proud of. Things I'm mortified to have done, really. But what I am proud of is that I accept my faults, I own who I am, and I live with the truth that we can all be better in terms of who we are inside. We all have that choice. I went to the local co-ed school from years 7 to 10, but I moved to a renowned private school in year 11 to undertake my VCE. My parents sacrificed a lot so I could attend what was then a $14,000 a year school. Now it sits at around 30 grand per year, I believe. I'm very grateful for that opportunity now because I did do really well there, both in sport and academically, and I ended up getting fantastic marks that saw me accepted into Melbourne University. Yet being a student at those two wildly different schools also exposed me to two opposing sides to life. The local public school I went to was fantastic, with a wide variety of both sporting and academic pathways available, and with students from myriad different socioeconomic backgrounds. But when I got to the private school, prestigious and highly renowned for its elite facilities, academic results, and calibre of students, the differences in the educational hierarchy were highlighted for me as I saw an uglier side to life, a very judgmental, entitled mindset that seemed to come from being higher up the socioeconomic food chain, so to speak. To my eyes, it seemed nastiness was praised, even encouraged within the student groups. When I first started, there were girls who'd tell me, "Oh, thank God you're here and not at that school anymore," as if it was something to be ashamed of. Yet my sisters had gone there. My mum worked there. My friends were still at that school, and I certainly had no ill will towards it. I remember sitting around at lunchtime with the girls in year 12 talking about what some of them were getting for their 18th birthdays. "If I do not walk out the front of my house to find a red BMW with a bright pink bow in it, I will never speak to my dad again," one said. I couldn't believe this sense of entitlement from a 17-year-old. My parents had saved and scraped together every penny they could to send me to the school. My mum had sacrificed moving us all to Perth to be with Dad at his job in Frio just so I could attend this school. Whilst Dad had worked great jobs, and I think we were always comfortable financially, we certainly didn't come from money. Yes, we lived in a beautiful area, but my parents always bought the cheapest house in the nicest street. They always made sure we went on family holidays, and we never went without anything we needed. But the reality is that having four kids is expensive. We always needed 4 or 5-bedroom homes. We always needed bigger cars. So while it may have looked like we were really well off with me at a private school, we weren't rich. Mum and Dad always ensured that we had whatever we needed to be our best. New netball runners, school books, stuff like that. But we certainly never expected cars for our birthdays, let alone latest model BMWs with pretty pink fucking bows. What was great about that private school, though, was the incredible work ethic the teachers instilled in me. They taught me a lot about discipline, structure, hard work, basic respect and organisation, things that I'd never learnt at my previous school. There, my friends and I would spend our spare periods going to Macca's or sitting out on the oval tanning, while at my private school, spare periods were strictly study periods. We had to go to the library and do our homework in the dead silence, and I actually really loved that. I loved having the structure, the discipline, and the pressure to perform well. Now, as an adult, I always do my best work in high-pressure environments. And I did do well, finishing in the top 8% of my state's peers across most subjects. Whilst I do now believe that choice in schooling systems is going to be different for each individual human, I definitely thrived there. I got to see that if you put in the effort, you can achieve great things. However, I also learned that success can turn you into a very ugly person. Experiencing both sides of the education landscape further shaped who I am today because I saw how hard I wanted to work, how hard I could work, and how successful I could be when I applied myself. But I also learned exactly who I didn't want to be. I never wanted to have that inflated sense of entitlement that some of my classmates had. I didn't want to have that gross outlook on life, that one's privilege reflected their worth, or to ever look down on other people because they didn't have the opportunities that I had. Chapter 4. I don't have a lot of regrets in my life. I don't believe that you should regret things because at the time it's exactly what you wanted. But there is one thing I look back on from my high school years that I wish I'd done very differently. I was very into sport at a young age, and I was pretty naturally talented too. My sisters and I all played a bit of netball, did some athletics at school, but I was innately gifted and I probably didn't realise just how good I was at the time. I was always taller than average, which was handy for sport. And by the time I was 12, I was regularly attending state championships in athletics, sprinting, triple jump and shot put, and also representing my home state of Victoria in netball at a national level. When I was 14, I was in the middle of a game when my knee suddenly popped and blinding pain shot through my leg. It felt as if someone had held a shotgun to my knee and pulled the trigger, my kneecap exploding, shattering into a million pieces. I let out a horrific scream as I dropped to the cold ground of the outdoor court. My mum and my coach bundled me up and half carried me, a sobbing mess, to the physiotherapist at the Parkville State Netball Centre. Other parents from my team had also gathered, all of them unnervingly quiet. I didn't understand why they were acting as if someone had died. The pain had eased by the time I was sitting on the physio's table. "I've just jarred my knee. What's the big deal?" "Guys, it's fine. It barely even hurts anymore," I insisted, holding an ice pack to my injured knee, hoping that the events of the night would be dramatic enough to convince Mum to get me Macca's on the way home. The physio asked me to point out where the pain was and to describe the noise I'd heard when it happened. A very clear and crisp popping sound, I'd told her, and the somber mood only intensified. That sound, they explained, was a classic sign of a torn anterior cruciate ligament, and where I'd felt the pain was a good indicator that that was what had happened. The fact that my pain had subsided was also very textbook for a torn ACL. My dad, who was coaching Essendon at the time, was interstate for a match the night it happened. I remember lying on the bed in the physio's room and Mum saying to me, "Reedy wants to talk to you." She was talking about Bruce Reed, the Essendon Football Club doctor, and I couldn't fathom why she'd called and bugged him on a bloody match day. How embarrassing, Mum. "What noise did it make?" he asked. "Where did you feel it? Did it stop hurting 10 minutes later?" I answered all his questions and was surprised when he told me he was going to book me an immediate appointment and told me to give the phone back to Mum. After chatting with him a little longer, she hung up and told me that Reedy had said we needed to drive out to see another doctor there and then. "Mum, what the hell? I'm fine. Can we please just go home?" No, apparently we could not. After about a 50-minute drive, we arrived at the home of another doctor who was involved in the club, an older bloke who ushered us into his mansion of a home and sat me down on his bed. I was so fucking embarrassed. The poor man was in his dressing gown, his wife standing by in her slippers. We'd clearly interrupted them as they were getting ready to go to sleep. Seriously, why are we doing this? I'm fine. I can walk. At 14, I had no idea how serious a torn ACL was, and I was shocked when we eventually got back to the car and Mum told me I would need to have surgery. Soph, you're going to need a knee reconstruction. You're not going to be able to play netball for 12 months. What? I almost laughed at her. No, it doesn't even hurt. I had just made the state under-15s team, representing Victoria again, and the tournament was due to start in a couple of weeks. I'd spent months going through the grueling tryout process and subsequent training camps. There was no way I could miss out on that. But when Mum did end up taking me to McDonald's on the way home, I knew something was really up. Mum hated McDonald's, and we never ate it as kids, so when we pulled into the drive-thru, the severity of the situation began to sink in. Within 48 hours, I was undergoing a full knee reconstruction on my right knee. With the contacts we had through Dad's footy, I was put at the top of the list with Julian Feller, an internationally recognised Melbourne-based orthopaedic surgeon whose main area of interest was knee surgery. Julian was renowned for being the top surgeon to all the AFL boys when they needed operations. I didn't recognise at the time how lucky I was to have those sorts of privileges during my childhood. People can wait months simply to get an appointment with someone like Julian Feller, and there I was, bumped to the top of his list, knee reconstruction done in record time, just like I was a professional player. What I also didn't understand at the time was the recovery I was going to have to go through. At 14, I had absolutely zero concept of the emotional and physical battles I would face every day, nor could I have imagined the mental torture of having something I loved so much being so swiftly and completely taken from me. That whole incident and the period of time that followed really did change my life, and while I wish I could say it was for the better, that injury and recovery process really threw me out mentally. My netball focus waned, and I never quite got back to the level of potential I'd had before the injury, even though I did try at times. I worked really hard with my dad, who put in so many hours to help me train and get my strength back. He was running with me down at the park, getting me access to the best rehabilitators, writing up his own programs for me, pinching me the top icing machines from the footy club. Every advantage he could give me was mine when I needed it. But I was naive to how much I would actually have to work myself to get back to my best. While I was in rehab, I definitely took it all a bit for granted. I remember knowing I had youth on my side. I knew I was fit. I was naturally talented. I'd never had to put in much effort to be good at netball or sport in general. I naively assumed, regardless of all of the professional advice I was given, that I'd be fine to carry on as I always had and would come back as strong as ever. What I quickly learnt was, natural talent aside, I wasn't resilient enough to put in the dedication that was required to come back from something like major knee surgery. It kills me now, looking back, because I can see what my dad would have gone through, training alongside me and my mum, who had dedicated so many trips to training sessions over the years, with nothing in it for her, watching her daughter, who had been born with such a gift, slowly letting it slip away. I didn't stop playing altogether after I'd recovered from surgery, and I was still very good. I got back to playing state netball for Victoria at 16 and also played in the Championship League throughout my teenage years, which back then was one rung below the professionals. However, I always knew inside that I'd lost quite a bit of my motivation for the hard work, and as someone who was known for her leap as a defender, I knew I couldn't jump the same as I once had. I was actually offered a full netball scholarship to attend the private school I moved to, but because my parents had already enrolled me years earlier, the school took that as proof that they could afford to send me there, so the principal gave the scholarship to someone else. My first netball coach there was Eloise Southby-Helbisch, the former Diamonds player, and she saw so much potential in me. "You will play centre for Australia one day," she told me during a training session one night when I was in year 11. Despite being tall in everyday life, I was short in netball terms, so as I began playing at more elite levels, my natural key positions of goalkeeper slash goal shooter had to change, putting me in the midcourt. Aloise had given me the greatest compliment. It was the highest praise from someone who'd represented Australia for many years and someone who knew what it took to be the best. Still, I didn't commit myself the way I should have because, at that moment, Aloise believed in me more than I believed in myself. My whole life since I was 6 years old had been dedicated to netball. At the age of 13, I was looking at 3 or 4 training sessions a week, games on Saturdays, interstate carnivals, training on Sunday, academy programs, rehab, you name it. And I think that when you get to 16 or 17 years old, that's when it's make or break as a professional athlete. And for me, I broke. Not fulfilling my athletic potential with netball is, to date, my biggest regret in life. I live with guilt for the people that believed in me and who I subsequently let down. For my parents who sacrificed time and energy to help me blossom as a highly skilled teenager, only to watch me throw it away. I can look back confidently knowing I had the skill, and I'm at peace with that. But I'm also aware that professional athletes' success is just as much about their mindset as it is their physical ability, and I clearly didn't have the mental strength required to make it to the top back then. I feared the negative too much after my surgery. I was scared of the hard rehab work and the disappointment I'd felt during the process. My playing style had changed after the operation too, and I unfortunately allowed my ego to begin controlling my approach. I wasn't prepared to fail again, which looking back is piss weak. I was never bad, but now I was scared to be. I let down everyone who had ever believed in me, but mostly I let myself down. When I watch the Australian Diamonds games on TV now, I see girls on that team who I used to play with and I think, I could have been me. I think that's probably why I work so hard in other areas now to make something of myself, because I see so much wasted talent in that past life. I look back to a young girl who threw away a life that she would now love to be living. Of course, on the other hand, my spiritual side allows me to believe that there is always a reason for everything. If I'd gone that way, I wouldn't have had my beautiful children so young, and being a mum is my favourite thing in the world. But I won't ever let an opportunity pass me again. I don't want to live with that regret around anything else ever again, because I live with it every single day. I see these inspiring, strong netballers, and I know that could have been me. That could have been my reality, but I made the choice not to make that happen. My career wasn't cut short because I wasn't good enough. I was good enough, but I made a bad decision. Everyone told me not to quit. The coaches and staff all told me not to throw in the towel, but I chose, and I chose wrong. Now, if an opportunity that comes my way interests me, I've promised myself that I will take it, even if it absolutely petrifies me. I no longer see fear and run from it. I look fear in the eyes, with my brain already working away in the background, figuring how I'm going to burst right through it. I no longer see failing as something negative, but rather a crucial part of learning on your way to success. Never fear failure. Fear the regret you will one day have for not even trying. Trust me. Chapter 5. While I dated a couple of guys in high school, no one compared to the amazing man I met when I was 20, Jared Keisha. Jared and I were always destined to meet. It was honestly too much of a coincidence not to be fate. I had just broken up with a boy who, looking back, was totally inappropriate. I laugh now knowing exactly why my mum didn't think he was right for me. Parents are always right. This guy broke up with me because he wanted to go out with the boys more, and I certainly wasn't cut up about it. I'm pretty sure Mum high-fived me. After we split, I was invited by a girlfriend to a Tuesday night gathering at the house of the guy she had been seeing. A Tuesday night after we'd all finished working at the pub and I'd been at uni all day? Absolutely not. No, no. But I felt bad letting her down, so what did I do? Thinking I was being so smart, I turned to the no friend. You know, the pal that never wants to go anywhere or do anything, the girl who always says no. I told my mate that if our no friend agreed to come, I would too. So when she said yes, it well and truly fucked up my plans. That's how I found myself heading to Ascot Vale at 10:30 p.m. on a Tuesday night, going to God knows whose house, so my friend could hook up with her guy. Upon walking in, I realised that this was much more than a gathering. The house was filled with men. Big, strong, wild men. Music was blaring, bodies were everywhere. Where the hell am I? I also quickly realised that we were the only three girls at the party. Ew. It wasn't until I noticed a quiet Eddie Betts sitting with his feet up on the couch, tapping away on his phone, minding his own business, that it clicked. This was a football party, an end-of-season party, a follow-on from the Mad Monday celebrations that had kicked off the day before. Now, I was a football fan, yes, but these were not my people. These guys were Carlton. Ew, right? I was Essendon blood through and through, so other than the very renowned and popular Eddie, I couldn't have named one other player there. Fast forward to later that night, and I found myself chatting to a bunch of guys, as you do. One of them in particular stood out for his interesting conversation, his respectful manner, his eye contact whilst I spoke, which let me know he was really listening, and he had these drop-dead gorgeous blue eyes. He was charming, a year younger than me, but worlds ahead in maturity compared to the other boys I knew. And after spending the night in deep convo away from the group, we ended up sharing a kiss and a cuddle. All of his qualities had already hit the pass mark for me. What really caught my attention happened at the end of the night, as my girlfriends and I were about to leave. He'd quietly asked for my number earlier in the night, away from the group, but as we went around the party saying our goodbyes to the stragglers before calling it a night, he realised he actually hadn't saved my number.
Wait, Sov! He burst into the room in a tiz. I didn't save your number. Can you type it in again?
The group of lads burst into hysterics and he was aggressively heckled for what I can only assume was going against boy code by showing genuine interest in a girl so openly in front of your teammates. It's widely known that footy teams are boys' clubs, and I'd seen a lot of it throughout my father's time working in sporting clubs. So whilst it shouldn't have been a big issue, you know, being the nice guy, I knew that it was, in fact, brave of him to put himself out there so openly in that environment. It showed me that he was a mature, genuine soul who was unapologetic for his interest in me. When he asked me out for breakfast, I took it as another sign of his good character. An actual date from a 19-year-old? It was something I don't think my previous boyfriend had done in almost 2 years we'd been together. Of course, I said yes, and he told me what time he would pick me up. When the morning arrived, as I stood behind my bedroom door, rubbing what was left of my sports girl body glow bronzer onto my legs, I heard a voice in my kitchen. Hello, Mr. Shaw. I'm Jared Keisha. Nice to meet you. I froze. What insanity is this? What is this atrocity? What creature of this age doesn't just text when he's in my driveway, too petrified to come in and meet parents before a simple breakfast date? That creature was Jared Keisha, and he had been raised by his parents to be a beautiful young gentleman. Little did I know, he had arrived early and was confident enough to knock on the door without telling me, introduce himself to both of my parents and stand in my kitchen chatting to them, while I stood frozen, globs of body bronzer in my hands, one as yet untanned leg hoisted up on my desk, staring with shock at my door. My experience so far in life had led me to believe that this 19-year-old boy would text me a lazy, "Here," and that I should accept that as normal. A teenage boy showing respect and using manners and common decency? What the fuck was this? Early on in my relationship with Jared, I recall speaking to my mum about him while we had lunch together one day. Our relationship was still fresh, but he had slotted into my family so seamlessly, he instantly became a son to my mum. I don't care if you don't marry him one day, Sophie, but just make sure you have his babies, she told me with a laugh. After all, she loved his striking blue husky eyes as much as I did. And yes, those babies we eventually had are both owners of the characteristic Keisha baby blues. Jared broke up with me a couple of months later. I desperately wanted to grow up and play housewife. I think he had realised that he didn't want to be tied down at such a young age, and hey, upon reflection,
I was probably a lot for someone who had never been in a relationship before. Us being so invested in each other's families so quickly was a bit too much for Keish, as he was known, who had always been infamous for his work with the women. We split up only temporarily, and it wasn't long before Jared and I were back on again and going strong, though I did have a one-night stand with another guy in our time apart. With a friend of mine, actually, and it was spontaneous and fun, and it didn't mean a thing. We're still friends to this day, not that I see him much now, but that's one thing about me. I've always been very capable of separating sex from emotion. I can be mates with anyone, even after they've seen me at my most vulnerable. At the end of 2011, about 12 months after we'd first gotten together, Jared signed a contract to go play in the South Australian National Football League, the SANFL, in Adelaide. It was a decision I 100% supported him on. Even though I was only 20, I wasn't really worried about my boyfriend living in another state because we had an incredible bond, we were wonderful at communication, and I really believed that we were already years beyond our expected maturity levels. Plus, my sister was a flight attendant, and I had the privilege of accessing her staff travel discounts, so I knew I could fly over to Adelaide for $33. So when, as some dumbass boys do, Jared made the decision to break up with me again, though not until he'd actually arrived in Adelaide, nice one, Keish, it was time for me to put my big girl pants on. I knew he'd come back. He always did. I really did believe he loved me, but Jared was struggling with an internal battle between being so in love with someone he genuinely cared about at such a young age and living life as he wanted to as a 19-year-old boy. He wanted the freedom, he wanted to explore, he didn't want the pressures of being tied down in a committed relationship. But he loved me so much. So, what did I do? I offered him the chance to have both. At 20 years of age, I recognised a bond that was powerful, yet one that was going to be challenged. Here was a boy, I realised, who was torn between love and life, and I understood that at 19 and 20 years old respectively, neither of us needed this pressure. Neither of us needed to be forcing a relationship that, purely down to logistics, would probably not work out, even though it was one that had a love and respect greater than anything I'd seen with other people my age. Yes, we were absolutely in love, but would a bit of freedom hurt anyone? Would it damage this connection? I didn't think so, so I let him do what I believed he needed to do at the time. I let him go and scratch that itch, as they say. I gave him the freedom to be young, fun, and single when he wasn't with me. But it wasn't all about him. I got the exact same freedom in return. Whenever we were together, if, say, by chance I got a weekend where I could fly over and visit him or he could pop back to Melbourne, we were together. But when we were apart, we were free to do what we liked. It was a basic understanding that we both accepted, as it was fair, it was equal, and most importantly, it was honest. I would fly home from Adelaide, have a normal week at work and uni, and then head out with my girlfriends on the weekend. There was never any expectations that we would speak on the phone every day or that I needed to tell him where I was, and certainly not who I was with. And it went both ways. Not once did I ever ask him anything regarding his private life, if he'd slept with anyone else, who he was hooking up with, or what he was doing on a Saturday night. Still to this day, I have never asked him about that year. Why would I? What was it going to achieve? We had come to the agreement together, so finding out things like that would only risk hurting feelings. Why would we want to do that? So, while many reports over the years claimed that Jared and I had an open relationship the entire marriage, that is categorically incorrect. Yes, we were open at this stage, but we were so young, and I knew it would benefit our relationship into the future. He needed to get some things out of his system, and he deserved to do that. I didn't have the power to hold him down, nor would I ever want to do that to someone I loved. What right did I have over his life at 19? Forever is a really long time, and that's how long I believed this romance would last. So why not? People really struggled to understand it, and a few of his alpha male, highly insecure, acquaintances tried more than once to intervene in our private business. typical misogynistic males would lead the charge, the ones who would be quick to claim things like, what happens on tour stays on tour, but were the first to question a female's actions because how dare a woman be sexual or independent in her life choices? In their eyes, I was a slut. I was playing him for living my own life back at home. But of course, Jared was a legend for pulling chicks every other weekend when I wasn't around. Over and over, Jared would tell them exactly where to go. But hey, fragile masculinity will always eventually catch up to those who stick to such outdated societal norms. So many people couldn't wrap their heads around the idea that two mature young adults at 19 and 20 could communicate and navigate a sexually open and fluid relationship so well with each other. Or did it just make them feel uncomfortable, seeing two people going so far against what society had for so long deemed as normal? Was me going against the grain, side by side with Jared in a consensual, transparent, and respectful agreement, going to mean I was ostracized yet again? So many people really didn't understand where we were coming from, but they didn't need to understand because it wasn't for them to understand. When Jared returned to Melbourne the following year, we quickly got back together and 6 months later, I was pregnant with our first baby, Bobby. We weren't trying, but we weren't not trying. I had underlying fertility issues that were diagnosed when I was 17. Polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS, meant my ovaries were completely covered in cysts. Symptoms included acne, excessive body hair, and an irregular menstruation cycle from my first period at 15. Jared and I loved the idea of having children together and very regularly discussed being young parents. So when it happened unexpectedly on Father's Day 2013, Jared just 21 at the time and me 22, it was met with much excitement. Due to my ovarian issues, I hadn't actually had a period in more than 18 months in the lead up to my pregnancy, and I'd begun discussions with my mum about possibly freezing my eggs for use later in life. I started investigating natural ways to get my body working, as I would say, and discovered a Chinese acupuncturist in a shopping centre on my work break one day. PCOS help, his sign said. And whilst I was totally naive to what this treatment might involve, I was willing to give anything a try, knowing that becoming a mum one day was something I desperately yearned for. The man could not speak a word of English, and I regret that I became frustrated when I couldn't communicate properly why I was there seeing him. My lack of ovulation over the years had left me tense and very sensitive around this issue, and in that moment, I began to cry knowing how much fixing this meant to me. I took him out the front of his shop and I pointed to his sign. "Baby?" he asked me. I nodded and he swiftly took me back into his room, laid me down on the table and started needling me across my lower abdomen and weirdly, I thought at the time, my feet. Always striving to approach life with an open mind, I took it for what it was. A few simple pricks, a hefty fee, and a clip off my boss for returning 10 minutes late to my shift. My body had not bled in nearly 2 years, but within that month, she did. I'd never been so excited to see my bloody stained undies at the end of the day, and I told both Mum and Jared, filled with excitement over what it could mean. Later next month, I popped out of the shower and walked past my mum who was cooking dinner. I was still living at home at this point. "Fucking hell, Mum, my nipples are so sore for some reason," I told her. "The water from the shower head felt like razor blades on them." Without turning around, she let out a huff, a sound that sat somewhere between a scoff and an outright laugh, clearly finding humour in my naivety to the situation and well aware of what was happening to my body long before I had a clue. You see, whilst the language barrier proved difficult for communication between me and that Chinese man sitting in his shop window, his expertise allowed our souls to speak to one another. He changed my body that day. He changed my mind. And in doing so, he changed my entire life. I will forever be grateful to that man in his window. Once my cycle began, I fell immediately pregnant with a little boy we referred to as our miracle baby. Chapter 6. I'm a very sexual person, and I always have been.
I've often joked that I must have gotten my sensuality from my mother. As young girls, my sisters and I would tease her about how much sex she and our dad must have had because they had four kids. Only three times, she joked in reply. Only had to do it once to get the twins. Sexuality has been a huge part of my life from a very young age. As I'm sure many children do, I would often explore my own anatomy and was very intrigued by what others looked like. I don't ever recall getting a sex talk from either of my parents. I think it was probably just assumed that as the youngest of four girls, I'd figure it out myself somehow. I do remember, however, being confused at a very young age as to why my vulva looked different to my older sister's. I would sit in the bath, staring downwards in fear and confusion, something I can't comprehend my now five-year-old daughter facing herself, and it led me down an extremely self-conscious path of sexual exploration in my early teens. I have a vivid memory of being a little kid at my cousin's house watching a movie when a kissing scene came on. I had no idea what sex was at that stage, but as I watched that kissing scene, I felt a really hot and tingly sensation between my legs. I guess it would be the equivalent to a guy getting an erection for the first time, and I remember my confusion, but I also thought it felt really nice, not having any idea what was going on. So I knew what it was to be turned on from a young age, like 6, 7 years old maybe. Looking back now, I was also regularly having orgasms in my sleep in my early teens, even though, again, I had no idea what was going on at the time. I would wake up from a dream to this amazing, pulsating feeling coursing through my body with no clue I'd just experienced an orgasm. This is something that still regularly occurs in my body, regardless of the amount of sex or masturbation I have or have not engaged in. I can't speak for what goes on with sex education these days, but I strongly believe that sexual exploration wasn't talked about enough by adults when I was at school. It was all fear-mongering. Perform oral sex and you will contract herpes. If you have sex, you will get pregnant. A completely false yet widely held assumption that many women often discover to be untrue only upon actually trying to conceive. At no point was sexual exploration or orientation discussed in so-called health classes, and it certainly wasn't ever a conversation we had in my household. So, throughout my early teenage years, my friends and I would get our education the way so many young people do, by bouncing ideas off each other about what to do and not do. There were also, of course, the widely held rules of schoolyard sex education. Prevalent themes were: if you'd kissed a boy before reaching high school, you were epically cool. If you hadn't had your first kiss by the end of year seven, awkward. If you'd been fingered or touched a dick in year seven, you're a bit of a whore bag, but if you hadn't done anything like that by the end of year eight, loser. I fucking hate sitting here writing about myself from 20 years ago, but that was me. That was my friendship group. And weirdly enough, it was the norm for everyone to be clued in to what other people were doing too. You knew when someone from another school had been fingered at the formal after party. You knew who disappeared down the back paddock and dropped to their knees at so-and-so's 16th birthday party. And you definitely knew if anyone had sex because, whoa, can you believe they actually did it? As I developed, I continued to be extremely self-conscious about my body. I always had huge boobs, a lot bigger than my friends, and whilst theirs all sat nice at that age, mine did not, and I hated them. Being much bigger than your average 15-year-old, I hated the way they looked. I hated the way they felt. I just despised them. For this reason, the early days of my own sexual exploration consisted of a lot of giving. I wasn't confident enough to let my walls down to expose my own body, so I would allow my sensuality to ooze out by way of my passion for giving other people pleasure. My jaw clenches at the thought of it now, but I loved the position of power that performing oral sex on a male gave me. It was always my favourite thing to do. I used to think I liked it because I knew that I was good at it, but as I've grown up, I realised it was being in a position of power that I loved. It made me feel great to pleasure somebody. It gave me this sense of power. I savoured those moments when a guy always thought he was in control
And I loved letting them believe that, letting them think that they were calling the shots, that I was only between their thighs because they wanted me there, because I was a slave to their domination, their masculinity. But what they didn't know, what no man ever realized, was that no one ever got me between their legs or found themselves between mine unless I chose it. I was the one who made the decision to be there, not them. When Kendall Jenner and Phoenix Suns basketball star Devin Booker's relationship made headlines in 2020 after the reality star had publicly dated a string of NBA players, trolls on Twitter commented that the boys